Okay. Thank you all for everything you've written to me. We've finished 5 letters. I published 21. And then, as I mentioned, I want to do the letter that was not published. And then David Eisen asked me to speak about the letter, or letter in quotes, to Mayor Kahana that created such a controversy, and Rav Moshe Lichtenstein had to respond to its publication on the Sforim blog. So I'll get to that. But as always, a number of comments. I listened to the talk last week, and I want to respond to a few things and also some new things. And I thank Mel in particular, but you're not the only one, Mel, who there's someone else as well. So I'll get to that in a few minutes, because it's quite shocking, I think, what I'm going to talk about. But first, a couple things. I mentioned pictures of Rabbanim, portraits. Here's one from of Rav Yaakov, the great Rav Yaakov Sasportas, which I'm assuming it's posed. I found some others. I mean, we know who made it. Here's this was not posed. This was of the Chacham Tzvi, where his son Yaakov Emden mentions that, as it says here, it was surreptitiously painted. Here's a picture painting. You might think this looks like some English gentleman. This is one of the Gedolei Yisrael, Rafael Meldola. He was the Chacham of the Sephardic community of London in early 19th century. So this looks like it's posed to me. This is definitely posed. This is, we know who the artist was, Bernard Illowy. The second, I believe, the second real Rav in America, student of the Chasam Sofer. He's the one I spoke about who was in New Orleans during the Civil War. And because of the Union blockade, they couldn't get any Esrogim in. So he paskin that use a lemon without a bracha, so as not to forget. Here's his wife also. Picture. And finally, this is the great Rav Yehuda Assad. Now, the way it's described, this is not a photograph. It's described as follows, that after he died, they stood him, that Tziru also, Leman Yuchu, Limkar Tziruso, Vaver Gedolahi, the Mesasurbana. That's one of the Rabbanim who describes it. A number of Rabbanim speak about it, that he is already dead in this picture. Well, it's not a picture, it's a drawing. They wanted to have a chance to raise money, supposedly to help marry off his daughters, but he was already dead. I don't know if they did something with his eyes, or they just, paint the eye. They painted the eyes open, but he was standing up here. He's no longer alive. And but they felt it was kavod. It was the kavod ameis. Everyone could remember him. This created a bit of a cause celeb in Europe, and almost uniformly, if not uniformly, the Gedolim thought this was a terrible thing they did, but they understood why they did it. I'm surprised. I was reading, I was listening over in the car to the class. I said something, and I'm surprised we have such learned people listening that no one emailed me because I misspoke. It's not that I didn't know. Well, the other thing I didn't know, I'll tell you, but this I misspoke. I was speaking about Yitz Greenberg. I said he wasn't the Talmud of the Rav. He was from the Vardik, but then he becomes like a quasi-Talmud of the Rav. And then I also mentioned that David Hartman, Rabbi David Hartman, learned in Lakewood. Someone commented, Chaim Berlin. If you can confirm that, I'd like to know that, because
he told me himself. I spoke to him when he spoke, was probably his last time. I was zeicher to meet him at a Reform place called Temple Israel in the city of New York, in Manhattan. And I chatted with him afterwards, and he told me that he was a Talmud of Rav Hutner. He told me himself.
Okay. Thank you, Nissen, for that. That I didn't know. He definitely was in Lakewood, but he was a Talmud of the Rav. Of course he was a Talmud of the Rav. He comes from Lakewood, and he's with the Rav like 10 years. He gets smicha from the Rav. I knew that, but I wasn't clear. But what I didn't know, and I thank Moshe for pointing this out to me, is where is it? Here. He gives a talk, Hartman, Challenges Facing Modern Jewry in Israel, Reflections on the Thought of Soloveitchik, Kaplan, and Berkovitz. And here he speaks about his relationship to Roth. He mentions Lakewood. And he tells the story about the plane crashing. But he says that he was talking to the Rav. You know, the Rav encouraged him to go get a PhD. He didn't want him to go to YU. He said, go to Fordham. He wrote the recommendations for him. And that's when Hartman said, philosophy is dangerous. And the Rav replied, well, you know, I fly on the plane all the time from Boston here to New York. That's also dangerous. But sometimes you have to do things, even if they're a little dangerous. And he says in this lecture that after 2 years, he wanted to write the Rav a letter saying the plane crashed. But he didn't write him a letter. So that we here we have it from Hartman himself. It's not that it's often said that he told this to the Rav. He said he wanted to. But notice, that's 2 years. He served as rabbi for many, many years after that. So I'm not sure what it means, the plane crashed. The plane crashed as he didn't have the same hashkafa as he had in yeshiva. He didn't have the more extreme ideas that he would have later after only 2 years after leaving YU. So I'm not sure, but you can listen to that. I was talking about after dealing with Rabbi Adlerstein, and by the way, I have to give a lot of credit to Rabbi Adlerstein. What a mensch, and he's one of, you know, I have such respect for him. Take a look at the YouTube last class, his comment on it, that he's Moda Emes. He acknowledges and says he was wrong. That's such a we all should try to live like this, that if we make a mistake and it's corrected, well, we acknowledge it. That's what the Chazon Ish thought about. Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg was so great that when an error, when he was pointed out something that was mistaken, rather than trying to justify it, he acknowledges. So, and I hope I live up to that and acknowledge my errors. I said last class, what I couldn't remember, I mentioned that the Rambam has a tshuva about teaching non-Jews Torah. He's asking, you teach non-Jews Torah? And I said, it's not mentioned in the Mishnah Torah. To which David Eisen pointed out that he quoted Hilchos Malachim, that it says in Hilchos Malachim that the Goy studies Torah is Chayav Misa. What I was a little bit flustered by meant, what I meant is as follows. Yes, it does say that a goy, this is Hilchos Malachim, a goy can't study Torah. My issue was, though, the Rambam is asked, can you teach a goy Torah? He doesn't say, there could be a difference between a goy studying Torah on his own and us teaching them, because if we teach them, then we can instruct them properly. Now, it's that which the Rambam is asked, because he's asked, is this halacha, goy shasik b'torah chayiv misa? And then he says, does that mean that a Jew can't teach them? And the Rambam says, it's true. You cannot teach a non-Jew Torah, except he says, Christians, you can teach. So that's what's not mentioned in the Mishnah Torah. This is what I had in my mind, that he doesn't say that you can't teach a non-Jew Torah. Okay, I have two more things to say, and then I'm going to, or three more things, and then we'll pick up. I'll go maybe five more minutes, because this I think you'll find interesting. It just so happens I've been listening in the car. Rabbi Rekefet is giving classes now on the Sri Deish. So, of course, I'm listening to Rabbi Rekefet's classes. And at the beginning of last week, February 13th, so it will not, 1 week ago from today, he deals right at the beginning. I encourage everyone who's interested to go and listen. He mentions the Pioneer Hotel that we spoke about. Why? Because he talks about how the young Israel would have all its conventions. Remember, the Pioneer Hotel, the hotel without the hashkafas. And he tells an interesting story that I got from the son of Rabbi Strum, which explains what, when and why the young Israel at their conventions and at the, I guess all their events stopped having mixed dances. And it's at the Pioneer Hotel. Already, he says this was at a time when the Pioneer, where the young Israel in the 60s didn't want to have mixed dances anymore. But the Pioneer Hotel, it's Saturday night, would have dances. So everyone would go dance. And so 1 year, Shlomo Karabach was there, and he did a kumzitz, and everyone went to the kumzitz. No one went to the dancing. And after that, that was it. And then Rakefet goes on about how he wanted to publish this story in one of the Haredi or quasi-Haredi newspapers, and he refused to do it because, of course, they don't want people to know about the young Israel. And then Rabbi Kevitz says that they're one of the Rabbanim in this building, I think he said the head of it, his parents met at a young Israel dance. So when I do my book on the Halachic history of America, I'll have pictures, ads in the newspaper at various Young Israels, the Young Israel dances. That was part of it. Now, I do want to say, actually, let me save this for the last thing I want to say, and this will then take us in. Those who asked me about the Rav and it's in, and Kraft cheese, it's in Mipnine HaRav, pages 197 to 198. And here is the page of, where is it? From the tablet K about their cheese. And it says the microbial enzyme used in the cheese is of 100% vegetarian origin. So that's the old hetero that the Rav held by as well, which today is not accepted. And finally, in the book, I forgot to mention, the second to last thing we did was the Rav's Drasha of Chinuch Atzmai. And I told you that it's different in here than it is in the actual version. One of the differences is that on page 249, the Rav quotes something that he heard from Rabbi Chanan Wasserman in the name of the Chafetz Chaim. Rabbi Chanan comes to America in 1938. And so I didn't know before that the Rav had any connections or dealing with Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. So that's of interest. Now, the last thing I want to do, I usually only go 15 minutes at the most. This might be a few more minutes, because many of you asked me about this, and especially Mel, thank you for pulling all my attention to something. What is it? Why all of a sudden now are all the rabbis talking about these home businesses? And like we mentioned, the Pioneer, you know, catering hall with no hashgacha. I'm not sure why they are, but there was a video, an audio podcast, which appeared last week on Rav Lichtenstein show. Here it is. And I have to say that I found this shocking beyond belief, at least part one. And let me explain to you why. And to his credit, Rav David Lichtenstein pushes back really harshly. So the issue is, you know, kashrus and home establishments. Let me show you something. The Shulchan Aruch says as follows in Yeridea, Kufya Tess Aleph. It says that if someone is questionable that he eats non-kosher things, that you can't rely on him. And if you eat at his house, you can only eat things that, you know, 100% are kosher. And the Ramah says, V'yesh Omrim, Afilu mimi she'eno chashut, even if someone is not chashut, Rak she'en makirin osa, but you don't know who he is. You don't know that he's a muksak b'kashrus. Asur liknos mimenu yayin ashar devari, she'esh achush le'isur. You can't buy anything from him like wine or meat or anything that could be have treif in it. Unless he's a muksak b'kashrus. But then he goes on, miyu misayach etzlo ochalimo. But if you stay by him, you can eat. In other words, you see a Jew, and you don't know anything about this Jew in shul, but he goes to the Orthodox shul, he invites you to his house. If you don't know any better, you can eat with him. But you can't buy anything from someone like that unless you know he's a muksak b'kashrus. That is, if you know he's a religious person, muksak b'kashrus. And the Aruch HaShulchan, also in Kufya Tess, says as follows. V'cheina minag pashut, b'chol tfutzas Yisrael, that this is the minag in all of Yisrael, k'she'echad she'ein makirin oso, she'el musak b'kashrus, if someone, that you don't know him, that he's musak b'kashrus, if he brings wine or cheese or something like that, you can't buy it from him. You can't, unless he brings k'tav heksher mirav hayoshev al kiseh harav. Unless he's bringing a heksher from a reliable Rav, that you can't take anything from him. You can't buy anything from him. Okay. So what this says already is that if it's a muksak b'kashrus, you can. That is, someone is known in kashrus, you can. So David Lechtenstein, then, he interviewed two people. The first is a macher, one of the leaders of the OU, and another is someone else. And what I find absolutely shocking, and I'll tell you why, is the first interview. Because and David Lechtenstein is pushing back because the rabbi is saying you can absolutely can never eat at anyone's house. I mean, you can never eat from anyone who sells something unless there's a hashkacha, mashkiach, all that. And David Lechtenstein is pushing back and back. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't say this. The Rambam doesn't say this. They say explicitly you can buy if it's a musak b'kashrus. And the rabbi says, but there is a takana of the Vat Arba Aratzos, which I'll speak about, which says that you can't buy, and I'll read it to you in a few minutes, you can't buy anything even if someone's muksak bakasheris, unless they're kasav heksher. And David Kinsey says, but it's not accepted. It's not makubo. And the rabbi says, yes, it is makubo. And David Kinsey says, it's not. He says, he quotes Rav Chaim Kanievsky, who says you don't have to. He quotes Rav Nebensal. He quotes Rav Zil Arbach, who says it's not accepted. And then he starts asking questions. He says, when I was in the Mir Yeshiva, this bachur, this avrech, his wife would make cakes. And he would put it out Friday or Thursday night, I think, outside the Beis Medrash. Whoever wanted a cake, could you buy from it? And he's going on. And then he asks, and this is the question he asks, and you can listen to it. And this is what I find shocking beyond belief. He says, so let's say you're in a place, far out place, a traveler. He says, Hong Kong or Singapore, there's no kosher restaurants. It's actually not a good example because there's kosher restaurants in both those places. But take India, China or something. Can you eat with the Chabad? Can you have the Chabad Rebbetzin make food for you and you eat it? And the rabbi says, there's no hashgacha. He goes, no, the husband, the Rav, he's the mashgiach. And he says, no, you cannot eat there and cannot eat from there. He says that if you eat at the house, like they invite you Shabbos dinner sort of thing, but you cannot get food from there at all. And the other guy says, what do you mean? How are you supposed to go anywhere? And he says, that's what you have to do. Who says you're supposed to? You have to listen. I can't believe it. You have to listen to this. Who says that you're supposed to go? You have to do what you the right thing. So let me just say something, first of all, that the fact is that W. Lichtenstein is correct. This position, I'm not a posek, but I can tell you historically, this position of the Vod Arba Artzos was never accepted. And everyone eats at Chabad. We trust Chabad. Everyone buys their food. My son went to Salt Lake City 2 weeks ago with a group of YU and President Berman. You can watch. He spoke at Brigham Young before 10,000 people. You can watch it on YouTube. So, of course, where do they get food from? Who delivers it? So they eat at the hotel? The local Chabad. You go on the Chabad website. There's a whole list of things you can buy. You can buy a hamburger. You can buy chicken. All that. But more. Who's the posek of the OU? Rav Herschel Schechter. I actually saw him today because YU, today's a holiday, so it was father and grandfather's son learning. So it was in the base medrash in YU. Rav Herschel Schechter every summer takes trips. Like we do trips to Europe, he does trips. Do you know where Rav Herschel Schechter and his trips eats when they go various places? Of course, they eat at the Chabad. And everyone eats at the Chabad. The Eda Haredis eat at the Chabad. I was in Prague and one of the Dayanim in the base in Agodo on Shabbos, I became friendly with them. And where is he eating? At the Chabad. And I'll make it even more. Do you know where the OU Mashgichim eat? And I can tell you that because I was with them in Shanghai. I was with two OU Mashgichim and four Star K Mashgichim. And you know where we ate together? At the Chabad. And there's no Mashgiach there. So it's to say that you can't eat at a Chabad. And why can we eat there? Because they're Muchsak B'Kashrus. But I'll tell you even more now. I'll tell you that I think that it even applies according to the Beis Hillel, the Vod Arba Artzos. Because what's the Beis Hillel say? This goes back already a few hundred years. It's in Samech Hei, in Yoredei. He says as follows. This is what he says. He says that they made a takana that even if someone, Shaloli kach shum davar machel o yayin, ela im ken yesh biyado, katu v'chasum eza av beistin shana aseh b'hechsher. You can't buy anything from anyone, even unless you have a letter from the Rav that it was done properly, prepared properly. Even if the person's a muhsak b'kashrus, that is, even if they know this from person because of lopolog, we can't make a distinction. You're going to say, then who's the muhsak b'kashrus? So you make a rule that you need to have for everyone. So that's what David Lichtenstein was saying. It was never accepted. But I have a feeling that even according to the Beis Hillel, there's not a problem. Because what does a Beis Hillel mean when he says you need a Ketav Hechsher? He's not referring to Hashkochas like we have today where the people go in your house and do that. He's referring to a letter, a Chavostas, Hodah, that this is a reliable person. And therefore, you would need someone, if they come to the fair to sell, everyone would need to bring such a thing. And that's not what we think of in terms of, I'll give you an example. So then the fact is you have these people in Chabad. They're part of the worldwide Chabad movement. The Chabad movement testifies that they're muksak b'kashrus. That's why they're part of the movement. And that's why they still have Chabad houses. So even according to the Beis Hillel, that's acceptable because, the Chabad itself is testifying that these people are okay. I'll give you an example of this. You go to Lisbon. We're going this summer again, everyone. Please come on the trip if you want to have a great trip. But you go there, let's say now, when our trip isn't there. You need kosher food. There's no restaurant. So how do you get kosher food? Okay, and this is the way it's been for many years. The Rebbetzin of the previous, one of the previous Rabbani, she's a widow, she prepares kosher food. So everyone's been going there for years. I did it myself. You arrange with her, and then they deliver food to the house. Now, when they recently they put in something, which years ago they didn't have, the former Rav, who now is in Lausanne, he has a letter in there saying that Rebbetzin so-and-so is completely reliable. You can eat the food. And when I'm in Lisbon, I eat the food as well. But that's a ketav hoda'ah. That's exactly what the Beit Hillel was referring to. And if I had to go, for example, let's say I had to go to Oslo, Norway for 2 weeks on business, what would I do? I'd ask the Rav, who is reliable and who can I eat from? And he'd tell me someone, and then I'd speak to that person and I'd say, you know, can I hire you to make some food for me? Or maybe there's someone who does that. That's what the Ketav Hechsher means, that the Rav tells you that this person is reliable. So, but I mean, so I just wanted to say this, and now let's go on, because it's shocking, and this will never happen. It'll never take effect. No one is ever going to say we can't eat at Chabad. Klal Yisrael will never accept this. I don't care who says it, because it's not historical. It's, you can tell me all the halakha in the world, but Jews have always relied on local people to provide them with food when they've been told, if they don't know, that this person is a muksak b'kashrus. That's always how it's been. And so whether or not we accept that's in line with the Beis Hillel or not, I'm not sure. But that's just the reality. And that's, I mean, that's, like I said, the more Haredi prefer the Chabad without the Hashkacha over the local Rabbanim, who are often a bit modernish, if you. Okay, so now let's pick up. I've seen also that some of the people don't understand. They haven't traveled. They don't know what it's like out there. So, kol hakavod to David Lichtenstein for pushing back on that. And the funny thing is, the second speaker, he interviewed too, Berach Steinfeld, I think is his name. He's a Rav and Mashgiach in Flatbush. He doesn't seem to have a problem at all with the home establishments. A completely different approach than the first rabbi. He doesn't seem to have an issue with it, if they're Moksap Kashrus. Okay. Let's pick up now letter six. All these letters are interesting, but someone asked, Rabbi Yosef Blau asked me today in YU, in the base matter, she says, where did I get all these letters? How come Nadi Hafka doesn't have it? I said, who says Nadi has everything? Some things I have. So he was very interested in this, and he says that he never quotes anything from the Rav unless he heard it personally, or unless it's in written, and he says that's why letters are so important, because the Rav wrote it. He says, if you're going to start listening, this so-and-so heard from so-and-so, Ingla Davar Sof. He says, but if it's a letter, you have the Rav, and if he heard it personally, he says he can testify. Now, one area which the Rav was very important, in fact, his influence in it is more than the Haredi Rabbani. We'll see some of the Haredi Rabbani were much more open to Peshara, to compromise on this issue, than the Rav, and that's Mechitza. And we're going to get into the issue of Mechitza later with the case in Columbus, Ohio. So why do I mention it now? Because the Rav has a famous letter in this book, The Sanctity of the Synagogue, Baruch Litvin. There was a case where the shul wanted to take out the mechitza, and Baruch Litvin, there was a few of these cases, by the way, sued. Remember, people gave money for it's an Orthodox synagogue, now you're going to make it non-Orthodox, and as part of the case, Baruch Litvin, Mount Clemens, Michigan, that's where it was, he put together from all the different Rabbanim, he got letters about the importance of Mechitza, and then he put it together in a book. And in this volume here, beginning on page 109, from 109 to 114, and then it goes on, the Rav, a second letter, the Rav, he has letters of the Rav here, two letters actually, on Mechitza from the Rav. One called on seating and sanctification, and the other message to rabbinic convention, where the Rav speaks about Mechitza. I do hereby reiterate the statement I have made on numerous occasions, both in writing and orally, that a synagogue with a mixed seating arrangement forfeits its sanctity. So we'll get back to that. And everyone knew this letter, but here's an example of where something that everyone knew years ago, people had forgotten. I say everyone knew this letter from, let's see, you know, I didn't, I don't have the date here, on this, the letter. It's, I think it's 58. What am I talking about though? So, like I said, everyone knows this letter that the Rav sent when he dealt with Machitza because it's reprinted in the Litvin book. However, they took out, when Litvin published the book letter, he took out the middle section that deals with other matters entirely. And what I can say is that people had forgotten about the whole middle section. I don't know if any copies of this really survive. There was one copy, at least I know of. I never saw it before. And I think Moshe Schwartz, he found it in the papers of his grandfather, Gedaliah Dov Schwartz. Or Gedaliah Dov Schwartz, a young rabbi, he received this letter, as did all the other RCA rabbis from the Rav, which spoke about the importance of Machitza. And if you read the Litvin book, you think that this is the letter. However, there's a whole middle section, which I think is very important. And that's what I'm going to tell you about now. And I feel very lucky because I don't know if any copies of this letter survive other than the one that in Rabbi Schwartz's archive. And this, I think, is an important statement from the Rav on the halachic process. And I feel very blessed that I was able to really bring it back from the dead, as it were, this important statement, which I do think will be quoted in future writings of the Rav on how he viewed the halachic system. And there's no indication in the letter, I have the original letter, that there's no indication in the Litvin version that they took out these sentences. The Rav says as follows. One of the fundamentals of my faith is that the halacha is an all-inclusive discipline and system of thought capable of meeting any challenge. So the Rav tells us that halacha can meet any challenge. It's not backwards or anything like that. But then he says that we can't always, however, successfully apply the halacha the way it should be to find the answers. He says, why not? Because of our limited knowledge and the imperfect intellectual capability of the human being. He says himself, I am not always able to behold the halachic truth and see the light under all circumstances. Sometimes I can't find an answer. He says, many times I grope in the dark. He says, I examine and re-examine a problem and I'm unable to arrive at a clear decision. There is a clear decision. Maybe someone greater than me could arrive at it, but we're all human. He says, even the Talmud doesn't solve every problem. We have Teiku. Which, contrary to popular belief, although this becomes the common notion, Teiku doesn't really mean, it's nice to say it, but I mean, originally it didn't mean that Tishbi, you know, Elijah is going to come answer all the questions. It just meant that it stands. It stands until the end of time. But that's, Messiah can answer it. But, you know, normally you think of the Mashiach answering it, not Elijah, but okay. So it's a nice, Louis Jacobs has a whole book called Teiku. And in the appendix there, he discusses this, where this idea comes from. Then he says, the Teiku was a very prominent and characteristic feature of Torah Shebaal Peh. We members of the Halacha Commission, the RCA had a Halacha Commission. Problems of RCA rabbis, they'd send it to the Halacha Commission. The Rav was head of the Halacha Commission. And they deal with Halacha matters and come up with Pesach. Before the Rav, you had in Rabbi Simcha Levi. And then the Rav was in charge. He says, we members of the Halacha Commission are not partners in a contracting firm whose task is to provide every member of the RCA with a clear-cut answer to his problems. He says, quite often the answer eludes us. We have doubts. We cannot be guided by emotional factors. And therefore, if you come to a dairy, the Rav says, where it's unclear what the Halacha is, and let's say, I think he's referring to has to be a deraisa here. You know, he says that the Divrei Torah, you go after the Machmir. Sometimes if it's a Torah matter, we don't know we can't come to a conclusion. We have to go a chumra, quote, which seems to inconvenience some of our members. What's going on here is that in the 1950s, you had a whole group of RCA rabbis who were very much on the liberal side. And the Rav's going to speak about it. And they were pushing for more liberal approaches. And the Rav was pushing back against that. And he says that some of our members feel that we're too strict. But what can you do? Then he says, religious Jews have of late developed an intolerant attitude towards what they call the shyness and reluctance on the part of scholars to commit themselves on halachic issues. What's he referring to here? There was a whole movement. You had it in America too, Eliezer Berkovitz, but that he comes really in the 60s. But you had this whole push, Yeshaya Leibovitz, the Kibbutz Adati in Israel, of people saying, religious Jews who accept halacha, saying that now we're in a new era and halacha has to move again and we have to find answers to all the problems. Now we have a state of Israel and there needs to be a dynamic halacha. This isn't just coming from the conservative movement. You had a number of Orthodox rabbis using the very same rhetoric. And especially in Israel, you can understand this because, you know, you return to the land of Israel. We have a Jewish state. Are you still going to decide halacha like you were in the Golos, the diaspora? Yeshaya Leibovitz was very vocal about this. And he made many good points. So, for instance, take Shabbos. Halacha assumes throughout all the generations that on Shabbos issues, there'd always be a goy around to solve certain problems, to do certain things. Well, let's say now you're in Eretz Yisrael and you're living in a village. And there are no non-Jews there. And it may be dangerous even to bring the local non-Jews in. Jews have never had this where you're living where there's no non-Jews. It's just Jews. There's always a non-Jew around. So how are you supposed to decide halacha? So Leibovitz's point was that the Gemara, the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, they never imagined such a situation. So we need to reinvent, as it were, halacha. Or take Shabbos and another area on Shabbos. Now you have a Jewish police force. And of course, you have to assume everyone's going to be religious. When you decide halacha, you can't decide halacha based upon the fact that they're not religious. You have to assume if they're Jews, you have to give halacha, everyone's religious. Okay, so it's Friday night, and someone's breaking into my house. So I call the police, and the police car comes, and they arrest the guy, which is allowed because it's Pikuach Nefesh. Okay, so now what are the police supposed to do? They've arrested him. Are they supposed to stay at my house now for the whole of Shabbos? Or can they get back in the car, and they can drive back to the police station? There's no... Maybe we compare this to like a doctor, but there's no pikuach nefesh to drive back to the police station. And what do they do when he gets to the police station? Do they take his fingerprint? What do you do? What do you do at an airport? What do you do on an army base? All these questions. So you had a big push from Kibbutz Adati and others, and you had in America as well. And the Rav was not a fan of that. The Rav says that we can't go make decisions in all these areas just because people want this. He says, a rabbi who thinks he can solve all problems is implicitly admitting his own ignorance. That is, by definition, you can't know everything. And you have to say sometimes we don't know. If you say you know everything, then you're ignorant. I've told the story many times how when the great Rav Herzog was chief rabbi in Ireland, this is mentioned, I think, by Emmanuel Jacobovitz. Yes, as much Emmanuel Jacobovitz in his, he gave a conversation with Michael Michal Shashar. Because he served also in Ireland after Rav Herzog. I believe this is where he says it there, that there were complaints about Rav Herzog, one of the machers, president or something, because they walked by and they'd see late at night Rav Herzog's study, the light on, learning, and the macher is said to have said, has commented that he's upset with Rabbi Herzog. He thought when he hired Rav Herzog, the rabbi would know the Torah. He didn't want to hire a rabbi who had to still study. He wanted a rabbi who knew the Torah. So, I mean, the ignorance, there was a Litvisha community, but the ignorance is unbelievable. They would refer to Rav Herzog. You know, one of the people talks about Rav Herzog with his big, giant prayer book, not knowing what a shas is. But then the Rav says, don't accuse us of evasion. Don't repeat the complaints which are common in religious circles in Israel about a lack of boldness on the part of the rabbinate. That's what they're pushing in Israel, that the chief rabbinate, now we're in the land of Israel, we have to be like the Pharisees again and make takanot, get rid of the fast days. That was a big one. What do you need to fast today? It's I guess, Tisha B'Av, I understand, but the other fast days, you can make a very good case that now while we're in Eretz Yisrael, what do you need these other fast days for? And you had people pushing this in Kibbutz Hadati, they were similar to Young Israel. Remember I mentioned Young Israel before, the mixed dancing. Young Israel didn't want rabbis at first. It's so ironic, we'll get it today. The whole Young Israel movement, the beginning was Dafka, they didn't want rabbis because the rabbis were old-fashioned and didn't reflect the ideals of the youth. Kibbutz Hadati also didn't want rabbis. they wanted just educated laymen. They wanted like commissions of educated laymen who come together and make a decision. But that's against the whole concept that you need a Rav. So that only lasted like two decades or something, this idea that we can do without rabbis. And the Rav says that these people who are saying that the rabbinate needs to find answers, and of course it's also a Aguna issue. You got to find the answer to the Aguna issue. But sometimes the Rav says that you have to throw up your hands. It's you have to surrender because we can't solve all the issues. So lots of issues which, as Boo Greenberg put it, if there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. And that's, although she's the one that coined that fascinating turn of expression, this was the attitude, though, of lots of other people, although they didn't come up with that that phrase. This was the attitude of many, and the Rav, of course, pushes back very much against this. He says that those who argue this way are not conversant with halachic scholarship. And the Rav says, quote, "If there is in our ranks someone wise enough to undertake to answer all halachic questions by return mail, I would not hesitate to relinquish my position as chairman to him." So the Rav says, if there's someone who thinks that he can answer the questions that I can't answer, you can come and take my place and I'll resign. And again, this is part of the letter dealing with Mechitza. But then at the end, he has a P.S., which also doesn't appear in the Litvin volume, because he's speaking to, this is part of a letter to the RCA membership. He says that we should adopt a resolution condemning the Humphrey Bill pertaining to humane method of slaughter. And they should send a letter of thanks to the State Department, to the special attention of Assistant Secretary Herbert Hoover Jr. for a stand against the proposed calendar reform. So the first thing is there was a lot of movement to require stunning animals before Shlita. The Rav actually appeared before the Department of Agriculture, I think in 1957, and gave testimony. It's out there somewhere, the Rav's testimony. But there were people pushing this, just like in Scandinavian countries, that you can't have shlita without stunning the animals. So the Rav says we have to get involved with this. And also calendar reform, that was a big issue, which really was active before the war and never after the war. It wasn't such a big deal. And never really, the whole idea was that they'd unify the calendar. So to do that, you need to have like a blank day or something. So every week it's even. The problem is that for us, Shabbos, they can call it Friday, but if it's Shabbos for us, that's Shabbos. So if like America today were to announce that we're going to add on one extra day, February 30th, or February 29th, or 2 days, then May 30th, and they're not going to be Sunday or Monday, whatever they are, they'll just be, you can call them, make up a name for them. Every year they'll come, and then you start again, Sunday through Saturday. But we still have Shabbos, and that'll be chaos for us. How are we going to have people working? So this already began in the 30s. We discussed it last semester. Chief Rabbi Hertz, to his eternal credit, he wrote even a little book called The Fight for the Sabbath in Geneva. And he actually got the Catholic Church on the side to go along with this, even though dogmatically the Catholic Church is not tied to Sunday like we are to Shabbos. In the Catholic Church, if they were to say, okay, so next week Sunday will be what would be really Tuesday, that's fine. But they did go along with it, and that's an example of how the Rav said last week, for matters of joint concern, we do have interfaith dialogue. If it ever comes up again, banning of Shlita, we have to discuss this and get together with the Muslims, because they also have Shlita and Bris Milah. In San Francisco, they wanted to ban Bris Milah. And all these matters that, if they want to start having drag shows at, every local school. And, this is something that the rabbis and the priests and the Muslims, these are things that we could find common ground on. And the Rav was completely in support, as we saw, of that sort of interfaith dialogue. Ad Kan, letter 6. Now we go to letter 7. Letter 7 is to a man by the name of Zorach Varhaftig, someone who I wouldn't say I knew, but I interviewed him. Very, very important figure, a minister in the Israeli government, leading Mizrahi figure. I don't know what his position was in the cabinet in 6th. Well, I'll tell you now. What do I need to speculate? I'll tell you more about Zorach Varhaftig, because he has... many, as they say, zchuyos. He was Yes, from 61 to 74, I see, he was a minister of religion. This plays a role because if you read Michael Oren's book on the Six-Day War, you find something incredible that when they would have to make the decision whether or not to invade the old city, it dafka was the Mizrahi delegates, Varhaftig and the other ones who were the most dovish, who were opposed to it. They didn't want to expand the war. And it's ironic because today, the successor of the Mizrahi is the most right wing, as I'm sure everyone here knows. But Varhaftig, son of a great rabbi, Yeruchim Asher Varhaftig in Warsaw, becomes a big Mizrahi leader. He's a lawyer. And during the war, he's really the one pushing the Sugihara. He's one of two or three people who get on the Sugihara bandwagon that this is the way out. In the classes on the Mir Yeshiva, I spoke about it. And he wrote a very nice memoir in which he describes all the difficulties he had with the Rosh Yeshiva, trying to convince them to take the Sugihara visas. And he was very much involved in Hatzalah. He comes to America. He becomes an American citizen. And then he goes to Israel. He was very close to Rabbi Soloveitchik. They must have known each other already from Warsaw. And as a Mizrahi leader, he come to America. He'd meet with the Rav. So here you have a letter, not dealing with the some of the other letters, you know, groundbreaking issues, but it's of interest. I think it's of interest for two reasons. Well, the primary reason is, as I say in the preface to it, the Rav's high regard for young American Orthodox Jews who retain their commitment to Torah while achieving the same intellectual and professional heights of the non-Orthodox. It was often the case that rabbis, especially European rabbis who came to America, all they would do was badmouth American Orthodox and the young people and compare them negatively to what they saw in Europe. An exception to this, I mentioned before, Rabbanan Wasserman, who comes to America and here about 6 months. We have video of him, incidentally. Is it video or pictures? Video, I think, going up to the camp, the Torah Vadas camp in the mountains. But he gave an interview while he's here, and he said that the Baal HaBatim in America are better than the Baal HaBatim in Poland. He thought that Baal HaBatim in America, they're ignorant, but they respect Torah. But in Poland, he said they're anti-Torah in a way he said you do not have it here. So that's interesting. But look, they would look down on Americans, and you can see why, because they play sports and they like entertainment and all that. The Rav thought very differently. He saw something that the other rabbis didn't see. He saw in the young American Orthodox, here they have in America, the whole world is open to them. They can go to the universities. They can become scientists and doctors. They can have everything they want. And yet they remain in the Orthodox community. They achieve advanced secular careers in the Orthodox community. In Poland, it's not such a big deal to remain in the Orthodox community. Many did not, but you didn't have that that thing driving you away, the career element. You had other things. But the Rav is very impressed to see high-powered career people. We take it for granted today because you go down to Wall Street, the biggest firms there, and you see not just religious people, you have people even with yarmulkes sometimes. But in the 1950s, and this letter is from 1956, the idea that you'd have successful professionals who remain committed to Torah, the Rav is so impressed by this, and young people. So he writes to Varhaftig. And the problem is, he says, among the young, they're not really adopting our ideology of Mizrahi. They're not anti-Zionists, but they're not getting on the bandwagon. And he says part of the problem is that there's been too much political disputes, the Sheinim Malim V'lo Maridim, which don't have any value. This is a Hebrew letter. So he says that he has a suggestion how to positively influence American Jewry. He says that, and he says you'll be able to do this with the YU. Dr. Belkin will get involved. Rav will help. He says that we should bring the musmachim from YU a year or two to Eretz Yisrael, to Israel, and then they will understand what it means, this idea of Techiyah Datit Eretz HaKodesh. They'll be able to speak with confidence and enthusiasm of religious revival in the land of Israel. This is before Gross, before they're going to study there, but he thinks that you bring, after they receive Smicha, I mean, people didn't go to study in Israel then. People didn't go to study. You know, Karen Biavna was a place you could go, but this it wasn't a thing to go, and definitely not once you've already finished with smicha, then you'd go get jobs at shuls. So he says, the Rav says, if we want this, our ideology, which is Mizrahi, a whole Mizrahi, we want it to spread, we need to bring these people to Israel. And he says, we haven't yet been able, for the good of our movement, Nuatenu, to pass on this, you know, these values. And we haven't used, I said, our movement, this great treasure we have. What's the treasure? He says, Dor Amerikai, a young American generation, Ben Tarbut Falichot Olam, She'eno Nofel Barko Entulatuali V'Mitzui Mechavrav Habaltitatiim, that we have here young American Orthodox Jews. He's saying this in the 50s, when there weren't so many of them, but what they didn't have in numbers, they had in quality, who said that in terms of their intellectual achievements and their professional achievements, they're no less than the irreligious, and sometimes, he says, even achieve greater than them, tied to Torah, full of yediot, of Torah knowledge. He's looking at the students at Yeshiva Student Sohanan at YU. And he's saying that these are the people that we need. We need to get them involved. We have to use them. We have to teach them what our movement is about. So they're not just like typical Gaulist Jews from 50 years before that. And they can be of value. And how we're going to do that? We'll bring them to Eretz Yisrael. They'll study in Israel. And he says the problem is that we have given up this the avodatenu achinuchit v'ta'amulatit, the propaganda or whatever for religious Zionism. I think that's an interesting letter. He says that we need to instill in the hearts of the young Jews that these ideas. Yeah, okay, so that's really the letter, and he ends it. That's the letter that I want to speak about, the importance. And at the end of it, he says, he sends a drishat shalom to his father, Rav Yerucham Asher Varhaftig, who was a Rav and a Dayan in Warsaw, and he made it out, and he made it to Eretz Yisrael. So that's letter number 7. Letter number 8. Letter number 8 gives us, it sort of relates to the Yalal issue we spoke about, because there was another mode of transportation, which people used to take in those days, and that was ship. I don't know if it was just because it was too expensive or people were afraid of airlines. Maybe some of you from that generation can tell us why. I can't imagine today anyone taking a ship to go to Israel. You know, how long are you going to be on the ship for? But people would do that. And there was the Zim shipping line. You'll see on the highway sometimes, you'll see the Zim trucks. I assume it's the same thing. And it was owned by the Israel government, and they had a ship. They had a cruise liner, the SS Shalom. I believe that had a problem later. I don't know, it sunk or something. I forget. You can look it up. But okay, so the plan was they're going to go back and forth from America to Israel, and Chas v'Shalom to have only kosher on the cruise liner. So Israel came up with a solution that I don't know if today would be so controversial. Have two dining rooms, a kosher and a non-kosher dining room. And those who want to keep kosher, go to one, go to non-kosher, to the other. The problem is, of course, that what does this message just send? This is owned by the Israeli government. And they're going to have... Now, for a long time, I thought that everything in Israel today was like Shomer Shabbos officially kosher. But I'm told, and we have people in Israel, they can affirm this. It's not true. So, for instance, I was shocked when I went to Masada and... So the cafeteria there wasn't kosher, and I asked why isn't it kosher, and then I found out that the plate's open on Shabbos. So this is an official government tourist thing, and it's open on Shabbos. So I don't know. For some reason, I thought that these things were officially closed. I don't know what the rules are and everything, but they wanted to have this the ship liner, and this created a big issue. I don't think the Haredim had such a problem with it. They don't really care that much. But for the religious Zionists who are in the government, This to them is an unbelievable Chilul Hashem. And it goes so much against in the, we're talking in the 60s, the idea that, you know, this is the beginning of the redemption. And here, and many of them thought that before you know it, there's going to be mezuzahs on every Israeli government door. And here you have the Israeli government providing non-kosher food. So it created a crisis in the government, a coalition, and great pressure was exerted. And the pressure worked. The pressure worked, and Israel backed down on having the non-kosher kitchen. So the Rav was very much involved. Now, I could see that some people in those days might have said from the government, you know, keep out of this, Rabbi Soloveitchik. You don't live here in Israel. You're in Chutz Laaretz. If you want to have an opinion, if you want to have a voice, move to the state of Israel. How often have you heard that? You know, if you want to say something, come to Israel, and then you can be part of the system. But I don't know, the Rav felt that he could get involved. And remember, the people in the Mizrahi party turned to the Rav. He was the one that turned to ask questions about this. So even though he wasn't living in Israel, they looked to him as a guide in these matters. And this letter is to Leon Gelman. Leon Gelman, or Aryeh Leib Gelman, was a Mizrahi. He dies in 1973. He was a leader of Mizrahi in America and then in Israel, obviously very close to the Rav. And he writes to him as follows. I found this in the Central Zionist Archives. The Central Zionist Archives in Jerusalem, I couldn't believe it. I'm there. I spent 2-3 days there. It's empty when I was there. Like, no one's there. And I kept asking for files. They bring them all to me and going through them and finding all sorts of great stuff. I have other stuff from other Rabbanim. As we say. So the Rav, this is the letter I found to Gelman. So he says to him, let me talk about this matter with you. He says that the news that comes from Israel is not just about the shipping line. He's also going to speak at the missionary threat. Missionary threat was a big deal in the 60s. And the Rav says that the young Jews in particular, religious Jews, it's really causing them a lot of stress, the news about the missionaries and especially about the shipping line. And then the Rav clarifies, who do I mean when I say Hanoar Hadati, the young religious Jews? He says, Enyeni Mitzapel Betziri Williamsburg or Lakewood. He says, I'm not talking about, I have nothing to do with the young people in Williamsburg and in Lakewood. That's not what we're speaking about. He's saying, Unzara, our people are very troubled by what they hear. He says, many have begun to ask questions. We shall say, look, Hakshul Kushyot, and ask difficult questions and wonder about the direction of our movement. How can you have a religious Zionist movement that's going to accept? Because there were those who said you should accept it because what's the difference? So they're not religious. So we'll have a kosher and they'll have non-kosher. And he says that there, and how much are you supposed to pressure? Are you supposed to then cause the government to fall? Are you supposed to leave the government? Then you'll be in the opposition. Like, how far do you take this? And he says they're asking questions about our movement. He says that, move on. He says, obviously, the attacks from the right wing are very great because, look, the Agudo is having a field day. You know, look at this, the Mizrahi, you know, the Mizrahi's friends, they're going to have a non-kosher kitchen. What's Mizrahi going to do about it? But he says the youth are confused. He says that we need to take a strong stand on this matter. And that, and the truth is, he says that the ones taking a stand are Dafka among our movement. He says the Kanaim, the religious extremists, he says they really want that the government to take a strong stand in the other way, because you know, this will support their anti-Zionist position. Then he says as far as they're concerned, the only important thing is the battle against the conservatives. But he says, I ask of you to tell our great friend, Moshe Chaim Shapiro. Moshe Chaim Shapiro was a very important Mizrahi leader as well. Lo lehitpasher, when it comes to two kitchens, no compromises. Rock, he says, just one kitchen, kasher, hu hapitaron hayachidi. He says, the eyes of the Tzibur Dati are looking towards us. And this will have, how this decides, how this comes down will have great symbolic significance for the future of our movement. And the Rav is saying that under no circumstances can Mizrahi agree to be in a government if they are going to have a shipping line that has non-kosher. Now, they were in the government when El Al was flying on Shabbos. It was not Shomer. Was it? Well, it was not Shomer Shabbos. Was it? Was El Al, David? Make it help me. Did El Al ever actually fly on Saturday? I don't know. Or was it just that they wouldn't care? They'd prepare. I think they did fly on Saturday. Actually, had flights on Saturday. Rabbi Kelman said yes. Government. Yeah. Okay. So I don't know why it's any more of a big deal, the shipping line versus flying on Shabbos, that they made. You know, the Rav says we need to take a stand on this. It could be because this became a big issue, and the Haredim also made it a big issue. It was in all the Haredi papers. So that's the first point. And we're going to see again in next letter, the Rav returns to the shipping thing. But then he gets into the missionary, the issue of the missionaries. And, you know, it's already 9:26, so I'm going to hold off on the missionary till next week because and I want to speak then, because I need a little more time, the Rav in Christianity. The Rav had what some of you might think is an unfair view about Christianity as a whole. And this then colored, not to discount the missionary threat, but you'll see that the Rav saw missionaries behind every corner. And even with Vatican II, the Rav was concerned that even things that appear innocuous, that really, there's a missionary right behind it, and we have to be very concerned. And there was an issue about missionaries in Israel, and the Rav's going to speak about it. You know, what's the law? Can you ban missionaries? I mean, so I'll get to that. It's already late, though, so we'll talk about it. So we're in the middle of letter number 8, but I don't, you know, I tried to at least start the questions 25 after, so let me get back. So Hadassah says there are portraits of Hasidic rabbis. Yes, there are many. My question is, though, are these actually, the issue we're talking about is where people sat for the portrait, as opposed to just making a portrait of them. And I don't know, that would be interesting to know whether they actually ever sat for a portrait. The question was, we know the Rav, for his 50th birthday, his Rebbetzin wanted a picture, so he sat for the portrait. I don't know how, I mean, it is Bittul Torah, I don't know, but I guess for Shalom Bayis, you can do it. So I don't know how long, though, the portrait took. Some of these artists are excellent. You've seen them, you know, on the boardwalk. You can sit down, and they can do it pretty quickly. So I don't know how long it took. But the ones I showed you they sat for. Nissen says that your encounter with Rabbi Hartman did not take place in the sanctuary. He spoke in the social hall instead. But he wouldn't have had an issue speaking in the sanctuary, Rabbi Hartman. Nikki says that her in-laws met each other at a Young Israel dance. There was a guy in my town. I told this story, but I'll tell it again because we have new people. So we had this guy back from yeshiva. I had a little little minyan where I go every Shabbos mincha. So for Shalosh Shabbos, we'd sit around the table, and this guy would, who wasn't a rabbi, but you know, he was back from yeshiva, black hat, the whole bit, and he'd speak halacha, hashkafa. So he said something about dancing, and one of these very old timers, Irving Miller, I'll mention his name because some of you might know him, Macher in Newark, president of the school, Hebrew Academy, president in West Orange of the show. He says, you don't know what you're talking about. He says, that's all we had in those days. The boys and girls would come together for the dances, and that's how they'd get married. And so they're having this big argument because the yeshiva Bacher was saying, it's usser. If they did it, it's terrible, it's wrong. And he's not a Talmud Chacham, but he's a very good Jew. And he's saying that you don't know what you're talking about. That's what we need to do to keep the young people in the fold. And what's the problem? And they knew a lot more than you did. So you actually saw it wasn't just one generation, next generation. It was one generation and like two or three generations later. And you saw the difference between someone who grew up and he says that, well, you know, we all met our wives at the Young Israel dances. Where would you expect us to go? Would we go to the high school dances? So it was something to behold. Rabbi Kelman says that when we lived in New York, he once ate at someone who's a mechutin to a prominent Rosh Yeshiva. And when he told us he met his wife at a Young Israel dance, let's just say his son, learning at Kolo, was looking for a hole to crawl into. That's part of the history of American Orthodoxy. So we have to be able to write it in an honest fashion. And someone else says, my parents met at a Young Israel dance. I have, as I said, I have the pictures from the newspapers. Young Israel had a newspaper, weekly or monthly. And you have like ads for the Young Israel Dance, and you have in Hapardes, which is the rabbinic journal, because it's not just Young Israel, attacks against, and it's not just Young Israel. When the State of Israel began, so they had the Hora was a big deal. So, of course, everyone's doing the Hora. And Rav Yaakov Moshe Toledano, he was chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he poskened that the Hora is okay, because the young... The young Jewish boys and girls sitting in the land of Israel, they're only going to have holy thoughts and all this. They're only going to be, have good kavanos and everything. You wonder what type of, like, it's funny that, he would say that, but they were so enamored. I don't know if an Ashkenazi Rav would say something like that, but so enamored, you know, the Hora and, Jewish boys and girls dancing that's, so there's a big attack on him in Pardes.
Dr. Mark, if I can interrupt for a second, yeah. I want to mention the name, but the son of one of the presidents of Young Israel told me that that all the Rebbeim, everybody, you know, nobody said a word against it because they understood that was America. That's how they meet. He said even the Satmar Rav, he didn't say one word against it because that's how it was in America. Many years ago. It's just, it is.
Yeah, the alternative was, fascinating
piece of history of Jewish.
Yeah, the alternative was they go to the prom.
Right, of course, of course.
The only Rabbi way Rizky. To keep the people religious was keep them, show them that it's cool to be Jewish and boys and girls come together. If you're not going to have any boys and girls activities, then you'd lost the whole generation.
Of course. And yeah. Talking on the horror, I remember when Rabbi Riskin spoke in Toronto, I don't know, 30 years ago. So he's talking about dancing to how maybe it's mutral pi halacha. They don't even touch each other. You know, the rock and roll dancing, you know, like the new, he was, their complaint said, okay, maybe halachically it's better, but there's something wrong with that. Anyways, okay.
For some reason, though, I know in the conservative, it's like Dafka now, you have to hold hands. So like we, our show will have a joint, we have a kafa where we get together like when it's not raining in the parking lot with the conservative shul. So it's like instead the idea of separate, they see it as like sexist or something, and I don't get it. And there's nothing wrong with separate horas today. Mel testifies he's traveled with Rav Schechter multiple times. We always ate at or got food from Chabad. I mean, there literally is no one in the world. You can go to the most extreme pace. You can go Satmar, Pesach Kroll, whatever group you go to, everyone gets food from Chabad. And if you'd ask them, they'd say they're Musaf B'Kashrus. And then you say, we're at the Beis Hillel. I don't know. I assume they'd say, I could have asked Rashad, but I assume they'd say, we don't accept it, or we're travelers, or it's they're Musaf B'Kashrus, whatever it is. But I mean, sometimes you hear things and you just don't, well, you know, it's not going to have an impact because it's no one accepts this idea. But it is interesting that it's only Chabad pretty much who can get away with that. I think anyone else tried. Right, take that back. That's not true. Something opened up a place and looked from and everyone knew who he's from. They probably could get away with it also, but no one does. As far as I know, everyone else will do it under the Hashgacha of the Rav, but, and Yaakov says as well, and Yaakov has traveled more than anyone, it was a rare Shabbos that he didn't see at least one mashgiach for one or more of the all, you know, having meals at Chabad. The rabbi who I was listening to, he said, well, maybe if you eat at the house, that's okay. But that's not what I'm referring to here. We're referring to taking out or eating at the Chabad restaurants. Chabad now all over the world has restaurants, which are not under, well, they're, as I said, they have a tuda, but the tuda is the rabbi who owns it. And that's, what are you going to do?
In Bangkok, Chabad has like a major restaurant. It's got two floors and it's the only place you can eat in Bangkok. And it's, you know, it seats hundreds of people. It's two levels and it's in the middle of the worst section of Bangkok, but everybody goes there.
Well, yeah, and I'd like to ask if we say if the idea is that we all accepted the Beis Hillel, the problem is we know that Rav Moshe did it because Rav Moshe ate at the Pioneer and the Young Israel conventions and the Aguda. So it's just not historical. Now, I do think I agree that today in America, you should have this takana because how else? You can't just have any single person selling food. We don't know. So it is a good takana. But that doesn't mean that everywhere you can't apply this then everywhere because that's what a takana is in a certain area. It's important, so you do it. But in Bangkok, how can you have a takana? He asks Lichtenstein on the show, so someone giving hashkacha? So Lichtenstein says, what do you mean someone giving hashkacha? There's no one there. The only one there is the Chabad. So he says, you shouldn't eat there. But I mean, that's just not the reality. And someone says his parents met at the young age of a Flatbush dance. That's another issue. It's not, I saw Flatbush. I mean, you had many yeshivas, schools and other things, not just young Israels, that had dances as well. Yes. Now, as for David Berger, it's a good point. Yes, Rabbi Yael, and the Lipton book was reprinted. I saw it, and I got it for my University of Scranton. We have the new edition, but I think it's just the same thing, right? I don't know if they added anything to it.
It looks like it's the same, but it's been out of print for a long time.
And Mel said that his parents been at the Young Israel Dance and spent many summers at the Pine View Hotel under the OU and mixed dancing and Saturday nights after the show. Yeah, I mean, all these hotels had it, had the dancing, and fine, you know, it's not the Ashkachas. The attitude was Ashkachas one thing, but then when they had the Glot Yacht, for some reason, with the Glot Yacht, that was the boat that would go around New York, and they didn't want to give Hashkacha because they said, we can't because you have mixed dancing. And I remember thinking, I don't get it. People have simchas all the time with dancing, and they give Hashkacha, and all the hotels have Hashkachas, so why can't, why is the Glot Yacht any different? Yannis says, do we have examples of problems that a solution cannot be found? Well, you know, the big one, of course, is people would say it's the Aguna question. That's always been the big one. Others say just the whole women's issue. People want, the Rav was dealing with, Aguna was an issue because you had the Olidim and Ketubah there. But you have Mamzerus, you have issues of, they're very, in the 50s, especially the 60s, the conservative movement was pushing against the idea that a Kohen shouldn't be able to marry a convert, divorcee. So these were all areas that you had people, and the attitude was that now we can make a Sanhedrin. There was a whole movement to make a Sanhedrin in Israel. And once you have a Sanhedrin, then you can make all sorts of new rulings and, that's why the rabbis were very, many of the rabbis, the Haredi camp, were so opposed to Heichal Shlomo, because they thought that Heichal Shlomo, which called itself the Center for Religious Jewry, that was going to be the kernel of a new Sanhedrin, and next thing you know, they're going to be making all sorts of new laws. And Barry says, or Kefet said, that in 53, Hartman came to the Beis Medrash Aritz and said, everyone sit in the floor and tear your jacket, the Chazon Ish is nifter. Yeah, he was a, he also said he went to Chaim Berlin. You know, Rabbi Hartman was a kanai a bit, to a certain degree. The famous Yortzeit talk, not the Yortzeit talk, the famous Hesped that Rav Soloveitchik gave for his uncle, the Brisker Rav, in the audience was Rav David Cohen, now is a big posek and Flatbush. He thought that something the Rav said was a bit insulting to the Chazon Ish. Because the Rav said, he contrasted, the Chazon Ish met with Ben-Gurion, and Rav Elvo refused to meet with Ben-Gurion. And whatever it was, so Rav David Cohen got up and started, he was being mocha for the kavod of the Chazon Ish. And the story as it is that the Rebbetzin, who was up in the balcony there, started screaming, you know, take him out. And it was Dovi Hartman who physically pulled Rav David Cohen out. And at least as the story is that they tell that Rav David Cohen called Rafutner, and Rafutner congratulated him, thought that it was very good that he stood up for the honor of the Chazon Ish. Whether you think that it was, that the Chazon Ish's honor was a little put down by comparing him to the Brisker Rav, I don't know. You have to listen to that. Mel says there, a Kefet recently told the same story about Rav Silver learning late at night in the prison of the Shul complaining. Okay, I heard it, and it was about Rav Herzog. This story is probably the sort of story that goes around that different Rabbani. But since you mentioned Rabbi Silver and related to what Rabbi Kelman mentioned before, if you read the history, it's in Rav Kefet's book, you see the heter that Rabbi Silver gave to the JCC to be open on Shabbos in Cincinnati, as long as they wouldn't take money and they didn't cook any food. But the fact that they allowed the building to be open, that was also the same sort of thing. It was Hurrah Shah that at least the people are there, because they're going to be going other places anyway. You're not telling them to drive. And you can today we never would dream of having a communal building open on Shabbos if we could. But Rabbi Silver thought it was vital to, no different than the tshuva of Rav Moshe, from Mexico that Rabbi Hirschberg sent, the sports club there. They want to open up, they want to have serve at the cafeteria there milk and meat. They're not going to serve together. You can't get a cheeseburger, but you can get meat. And then afterwards, you can get dairy. In other words, they're serving it. And so how can you give a hashgacha to a place that's serving milk and meat? The problem is, if you don't give hashgacha to it, they're going to serve tarfas. So Rav Moshe says, yes, you can give hashgacha to it. The firm will know you. If you're having the meat, you can't have the milk. If the non-religious want to have the meat and then they want to get some milk after that, that's their problem. But at least you keep it kosher. And that's what you have to do sometimes in places where you can't get it. Mahadran, min mahadran. Rav Avadya says that in situations like that, and he's speaking about in Israel, you're obligated to give hashgacha to the place because that'll keep them, at least they'll be eating kosher. And at Tzitz Eliezer, is outraged by this. He says, how can you give hashgacha to a place that's going to be serving milk and meat together? The people are going to be eating it one after the other. And okay, a couple more things. Yes, Yishai Ledwitz, Ben Melch says he objected to the rabbi saying, let those other Jews, the non-dati, do the Shabbos test. And Leibovitz is right about this. Rabbi Chaya Weinberg understood this, and the Rav also. You can't create a halacha in the state of Israel in which you say, for example, if you're going to have a police force, and if you assume that it should be a Shomer Shabbos, you can't say, well, let the irreligious do it. And, no, if you need a police force, and then religious Jews have to do all these things. So all the religious Zionist poskim understood this, though. It's see, for the Haredi poskim, for many of them, this is like Hilchas of the Mashiach. You know, how to run a police force on Shabbos. This isn't something that's within their ken or their understanding, you know, a police force or an army on Shabbos. That's, like I said, in Messianic times. But for them, it's not, because they're not in the police force. They're not in the army. So that's really not their concern. But for all the religious Zionist poskim, obviously, you need to set up halachot, how to run a police force. There was a whole journal. It's called HaTorah V'Hamedina, which they dealt every issue with these matters. And sort of, Tehumen has sort of come along with that. David says, in response to Blue's famous statement, where his halacha rabbinic will is halachwe, Rav Lichtenstein responded, so in other words, im tirtzu, ein zo halacha. Okay, that's a play on, if you wish it, it's not, ein zo agada. Right, Herzl, right? So, and he says his name is Zerach, not Zorach. The problem is that,
Rabbi Dr. Mark, I can
the problem is that, I don't know, David, why you say that. Because if the reason I say it's Zorach is because in his book, when it appeared in English, it's written Zorach, I guess. And that apparently is how he wrote it in English, I believe. So I don't know. I'll tell you right now. Hold on. Because I have his book at my university library, and yeah, it's Zorach. That's what he calls himself, Zorach. So I don't know. Well,
Rabbi Dr. Mark, I have a picture that I took at the UN about a week or so ago, and it clearly says Zorach. He was a Warsaw rabbi and lawyer.
Why was that at the UN?
There's an exhibit now on a very, very good exhibit on a lot of stuff to do with the Holocaust.
Oh.
And Zerach Wahaptig was one of the negotiators. They mentioned about Sugi Haran. They mentioned how he negotiated with the forerunner of the UN, the UNRR, that dealt with the refugees, the UNRRA.
Okay. I see, by the way, so David says in Hebrew Wikipedia, its name is Zerach, but people would pronounce it Zorach. But the point is, he himself, in his English works, wrote Zorach. So that's how he signed it. So you can ask his son, Itamar, but he went back to Lithuania, and they made a movie. He was in his 90s, and the camera crew came with him, and he also went to Japan. It's all this big movie, and he reunites with all these people. It's really a great movie. I see we've gone on long enough, so... I'm sorry, I'm not going to get to the other ones. There's so many good comments here. But David says that El Al found a way to fly on Shabbos. It incorporated a subsidiary, which does fly on Shabbos. You're speaking about today. I guess. And Amalia says there was no singles crisis then. It currently leases, okay, so now it's known as Arkea, and it leases, but if it's not LL, then it's fine, I guess. Whitey Horowitz's sister told me how she and her husband met. Okay, lots of interesting things here. A final comment, Rabbi Shudno. Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz was my great support in the Navy while stationed in the Chicago area. Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz was a great man, a great halachic authority, and I can tell you that I went and I looked in the archives of the RCA, and because for my project on halachic history, and I found some stuff. Not so much, but I found some stuff, and I found no tshuvos of Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz. So I was very excited, and I showed it to the family, the grandson I mentioned, and they already had it, and they're coming. They're going to be publishing supposedly a volume of his tshuvot, and he had correspondence with you know, other gedolim, and so we can look forward to that. And finally, MJF, I think they sold the Shalom to a German cargo. You sailed on the last Zim passenger ship with American friends at Hebrew University to start my junior year, but the Shalom, I'm talking about the ship, it was called Shalom, I believe, it sunk, I think. Yeah, you can look online, I'll tell you right now, there's a whole, here, I'll show you something while I just pulled it up. You find this. There's a whole page here on the SS Shalom. That was the flagship. That was the one where they're going to have but the problem was, I thought that the ship, sunk,
Yeah, if you look at Wikipedia, it says that it sunk in 2000 something, yeah, 2001 off Cape St. Francis, South Africa.
Okay, but it wasn't part of an Israeli ship then. It had been sold, right, by then. They sold it to Germany in 1967.
German Atlantic Line, 67, it does say.
Okay. That. So thank you all for coming out again tonight, Rabbi Kelman. Or anyone else?
I think we have a minion of people here who met at Young Israel Dances. Them were their parents. I find that such a sociological, interesting comment that says, well, I just found that like, well, my parents, my in-laws, this one, I went to Young Israel Dance. Well, by the time I was dating, the Young Israel Dances were long over. So, whatever. But anyways, okay. But, thank you, everybody. Tomorrow, 11 a.m. Dr. Sokolow talking about going back in history, the songs of the Chalutzim, fascinating, you know, interesting topic, of course, going through the songs of the early Zionists, and then Rabbi Shulman on Sefer Daniel going back 2,500 years. And then, of course, continuing Wednesday, Dr. Lindsay Guhartz, and then Rabbi Levine finishes off his four-part series on the Shulchan Aruch this week, the Parsh, Shia regular stuff, Thursday, Dr. Lasker finishes his series on philosophy also this week on Thursday, and my shiur and the Siddur continuing, and all our continuing shiurim going on. Rav Amnon Bazak will be giving a shiur be'ivrit on Sunday at 12:30, I mentioned on Purim, and Malka Simkowitz will be giving a shiur. That was just finalized like about 8:25 this afternoon before the shiur next Wednesday. We'll send out a thing also on Purim. Okay, we look forward to learning with you. And please invite a friend to come. And everybody have a wonderful night and a wonderful day. And Chodesh Tov, Mishnah Nas Adar. We should have lots of smachot and good times, good things to celebrate. And thank you very much. Okay, Laila Tov, everybody. Or Boker Tov, David, to you. But Laila Tov to everybody else. And thanks for all your information. Okay, very good.
Chodesh Tov.
Chodesh Tov. Chodesh Tov to everybody. Okay.